Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. And if you're listening to us in real time, I think everybody in this studio today is pretty happy. A weekend without snow and ice is upon us. And I hope if you're listening in sections of the state where you suffered from this January snow, you're thawed out and moving towards better weather, too. Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the AJC, is here. You read him in the Dead Tree edition of the newspaper on Wednesdays and Sundays. And he oversees the Political Insider blog as part of Politically Georgia at the MyAJC website. Can you give us just a hint of what we're going to talk? You're going to write on Sunday, or what you've written for Sunday?
Nathan Deal, as the author of the Georgia GOP Guide to Surviving the Anti-Trump Tsunami.
And that's really a tease for later in the show, because we're going to ask you to go into that in some depth.
Right.
It's a fascinating, you've shared that column with us, and it's really an interesting piece. Julianne Thompson, a Republican insider, political consultant. She's been involved in leadership roles in the state Republican Party. Julianne, am I right that at one point you also were one of the founders of one of the earlier Tea Parties in Georgia?
That is true. I was one of the early founders of the Atlanta Tea Party.
Okay.
A long time ago.
A triumvirate, as I recall,
yeah.
Right?
A long time ago, 2009, when
seems
it first
forever
started.
Ago.
It was. It
back
was
when the Tea
ago.
Party still was relevant in some
back when the Tea Party was about fiscal responsibility and limited government.
Yeah.
Yep.
Also, we're joined today, and I saved you for last for a reason, Nan Orrick, Senator Nan Orrick from Atlanta. And the reason I saved you for last is because I want to mention an honor you received this week that was really a thrilling for me to read about, having known you for a long, long time. You were inducted this week, or last week, in the International Civil Rights Walk of Fame, which is a function of the Trumpet Awards Foundation, and it's Zernona Clayton, one of the great women in the civil rights movement. Congratulations. They're recognizing you for your work in civil rights.
Thank you. It's humbling. It really is, because the list of honorees that goes back to the early 2000s is many of the giants.
There are people like Sidney Poitier,
oh,
I think.
Absolutely.
Ted Turner.
Yes.
Jesse Jackson.
Yes. Jimmy Carter.
Jimmy Carter.
Uh-huh. It's really quite an honor. And the big news is that they are moving that walk of fame over to the Koch National Center for Civil and Human Rights.
Oh, really?
Complex.
So do you get what do you get? Is there a star in the sidewalk? Is this like the
that's
Hollywood
right,
Walk
that's
of
right.
Fame?
That's right. It's well, they've actually taken our shoes, and our footprints will be imprinted on that Walk of Fame, and that'll be newly installed over these next months over at the right outside the Center for Civil and Human Rights.
Well, congratulations, Jim. We can say we knew Nan Wen.
Oh, my goodness.
Back during the early, early days when your hair wasn't quite so
silver.
That's
silver.
Right. That's
we also congratulate you on the birth of your first grandchild, your granddaughter, Rose. You were up in Chicago visiting her.
Indeed.
And the pictures of you and the baby are really lovely to look at.
Thank you, Bill. It's the treasure of a lifetime. Of course, my older son and his wife have given birth, and they're great parents, and we've got a happy little baby girl.
Julianne, while we're doing good in welfare, which normally we reserve for the end of the show, do you have anything you want to share with us?
Well, it's been very nice to be able to spend a couple of days with my children on these snow days, and I was ready for them to go back to school.
She has the look of an escapee from the chain gang.
All right, let's get started with the news. There's some really significant political news. Probably the most important breaking story right now is that President Trump, the deadline, a government shutdown looms at midnight tonight. Democrats, Republicans, and within their parties have been unable to come up with a compromise that would somehow extend DACA, deferred action for childhood arrivals, and give Trump some of what he wants toward a wall. And the deadline looms. But Jim Galloway, about maybe an hour and a half ago, President Trump invited Chuck Schumer to come over to the White House. He'd been talking about the Schumer shutdown, blaming it on the Democrats. But now he is saying he wants to try to work something out in these final hours.
Yeah, and that's not too surprising. I mean, look, he can call it the Schumer shutdown as much as he wants to, but the truth is, I mean, the Republican Party has control of the House, the Senate, and the White House. excuse me, a little cough there. The House has decided to remain in session. They were supposed to.
House has already passed the measure.
Yes, but they decided to remain in session because if there's a deal that's in any way different from what the House approved, they're going to have to approve it again. So they've decided not to go home, and I think that's probably a good decision.
You know, Julianne, I want to share with you just a personal feeling and get your response to it. The jockeying back and forth about who's to blame is certainly going on among both Republicans and Democrats. The president's been tweeting it's all the Democrats' fault. Schumer last night gave remarks on the floor of the Senate essentially saying it's Trump's fault, it's the Republican Party's fault. Do you think in the long run the American people, I get the polls suggest that maybe Republicans will get more blame. But in the long run, is this a game that has very little to do with the reality of what a shutdown does to the lives of people?
That's exactly what it is. And I think that the American people are tired of both parties using these issues as issues that they are looking to use for future elections as a reason to play politics with issues like this that are so important to the American people. And I hear it from parents on the bleachers when I go to games. I mean, I hear, why don't both parties just come together and you know, do the job of the American people? So I think they're tired of it.
Yeah, and I got to say, Bill, what's interesting about this one is that party discipline on the Republicans on the Senate Republican side isn't holding on this. You have Lindsey Graham and others saying, no, we're not going to do this. And of course, Graham is one of those who tried last week to broker that compromise over DACA.
Yeah.
Well, and it's involving children, of course. The kind of callous manipulation of hugely important policies.
Yeah,
one on the Dreamers, 800,000 young people whose fate is in the hands of what Congress does, and the Peach Care for Kids that we enjoy for so many of our working families here in Georgia. That federal funding program has been held up. They could have resolved those things, but it's classic, crass politics on the part of the GOP to not look for solutions on those earlier so that they can use them now to tie things up.
That said, Nan, mm-hmm. You know that while, again, the polling does suggest that Republicans are going to bear more of the blame if the government shuts down, Democrats have a stake in this as well. Without a DACA, if Democrats keep kicking the can down the road, complicit with the Republicans, and we don't get a new DACA deal, it's Democrats who are going to pay the price among voters who thought they could count on Democrats to advance their issues like DACA.
Well, no, that's precisely the shutdown. That's one of the issues. The Democrats are saying we're not going to go along with a deal that doesn't include addressing 800,000 young people who are contributing members of our society in states all across the country, and they're being actively mistreated. And the president had actually committed to address DACA and see that things were made right, and it was the Obama-era deferrals were continued. But he has chosen not to do that.
I don't believe that Speaker Ryan wants the DACA issue to be part of the CR. I believe he made
continuing
that
continuing resolution.
That's right. That's right. And he made that clear about a week ago. But as the senator said, there were talks, you know, that were on the air between the president, between Republicans and Democrats, that they allowed them to come the press to be part of, and everybody thought that there was going to be some sort of a deal. And I don't think that this is the time to blame one party over the other, because I think it's the fault of both sides.
Well, but there
But I don't think that there's going to be a DACA deal without a deal on the wall. I just don't believe it.
There is no question, though, Jim, that President Trump's equivocating on this, saying first, yeah, we get DACA, we want a clean DACA bill, we get that done, then we'll address these other things. Then he's back and forth on this. That is certainly McConnell, even the majority leader, says, I don't know what the president wants, and I can't do anything until I find that out.
Right, right. And and actually, that's the one thing that united Dick Durbin and Mitch McConnell last week, that they're not sure who's cutting the deal in the White House.
Let me bring this issue home. We have people in Georgia, number one, who work for federal agencies who, if the government does shut down at midnight tonight, will be out of a paycheck for the time being. And we have any number of people, we have many people in Ann Arbor who rely on federal government services who will be hurt by a shutdown.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But we know what parties run in Washington now. And that is who will take the blame. And I believe Trump, before he got into politics, was quite vocal about it'll be the president if there's a shutdown, pointing at Obama in that case. And that's where people will point now.
The version that was passed, I've got a question for the panel here. The version passed by the House, did that include the permanent CHIP extension?
I believe it did. Yes, it included did. Money it for CHIP, which again, as Nan Orrick points out here, we call Peach Care, the
Peach
insurance
Care for kids.
Program
mm-hmm.
For kids. So, Julianne, the president calls Schumer to the White House. You know, one of the scenarios painted by a lot of people has been this is a master at marketing and promotion. So he's been glad to let this thing hang in the wind for the time being. Now he comes to the rescue at the last minute. We should point out that he was supposed to leave for Mar-a-Lago at like 4:30 this afternoon. The White House announced that that's not going to happen. He's going to stay in Washington. He's got a huge gala, though, a one-year anniversary gala at Mar-a-Lago. People are paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to be there. So what's your guess? Are we going to see the president ride to the rescue at the last minute or portray it as if he's doing that?
Well, I think he's doing the right thing by staying in Washington. That's his job. And from what I understand, he's going to be appearing via satellite in Mar-a-Lago at the gala. But his job is to be the president of the United States and to lead. So I think that it is a good thing that he has invited Schumer. But like I said, that happened last week and the talks fell apart afterward. I think Lindsey Graham said in the hearings the next day, I don't know what happened between 10 a.m. and noon, but that he believed that staff was giving the president some very, very bad advice. So we'll see what happens.
You know, if there's – this is one instance where Trump's ability to make everything in D.C. be about him, where it might actually pay off a little bit, because tomorrow is the 20th anniversary of his inauguration.
The first anniversary of his inauguration.
Okay. All right,
it feels like 20.
Okay,
to many.
All right, it's the first one. Okay, I'm sorry. And you've got. I doubt that he really wants a shutdown to be the way that's celebrated.
Yeah, well, Tom Faust is monitoring the wires to see if while we're on the air, we hear any news out of the White House about the visit that Chuck Schumer is making over there. We believe it's unfolding right now. So we'll keep you informed if things develop throughout the next hour. Jim, let's talk about that column. Since we're talking about Trump and his impact on the country, on politics, let's talk about the column that you have coming up on Sunday. You've made an interesting point. If you don't mind, I'll set the stage for it, and then you talk. You tell us that Karen Handel was invited the other day to address a group of Republicans.
The NRCC.
The National Republican Congressional Committee, Campaign Committee, about how you run in an anti-Trump environment, because in a sense, that's what she did when she beat John Ossoff. She went up against a Democrat in a district that was a swing district, was a very fragile Republican district, and she won. So she was invited to tell them how she did it. Talk a little about that, but then, if you don't mind, tell us why you think there's another Georgia figure who is even more important to the story of how to run against in this Trump era.
Now, well, it was a closed door session, so we don't have, and Handel has declined to talk about it. So we're getting secondhand reports. And one line that appeared to in Politico kind of struck me was that she was saying, you know, you can in this climate you can still get your people out by demonizing the other side. In this case, you know, her example was Nancy Pelosi. And the phrase "San Francisco values" was spread.
Yeah,
quite
we all remember that commercial.
Thing. Yeah, yeah, but that and that could work in congressional districts because of the way they have been packed on both sides. You know, very very heavy Democrat or very heavy Republican, but it really doesn't help if in a gubernatorial race, and it doesn't help in legislative races. You know, Nancy Pelosi just doesn't figure into the Georgia legislature. And so, you start saying, okay, who's got the model for it? And the AJC came out with a poll last week, and it showed, number one, that Donald Trump's numbers, his approval numbers in Georgia, were just dreadful, 36%, which is worse than the current national figures, actually. But Nathan Deal's numbers were 52, approaching 53, I think. Likewise, you have you had Georgians saying their state was on the right track, I think 64%.
Yeah.
Only 41% thought the nation was on the right
so
track.
So what is Nathan Deal's secret?
Well, I mean, he's pulled something out of the Democratic playbook, and that is basically to create a party brand that's independent of and insulated from Washington. I mean, if you watch Joe Frank Harris, Zell Miller, back in the day, they had to do this all the time. That the only time I can think of a Republican has done it since they took over, it was Sonny Perdue kind of ran away one time ran away from a tarmac meeting with Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
But the other part of that is he has kind of recognized, and this religious liberty is a part of that. He's recognized that Georgia's economic insecurity is greater than its cultural insecurity. And so he has, with a few exceptions, he's given more weight to that. And you can see that in the pursuit of Amazon, in the protection of the state's film industry.
So I want to get Nan and Julianne to respond to that. I mean, you know, Nan, you're a Democrat, so I'll start with you. Jim makes a good point. Early in his administration, Deal did get involved in kind of a hot-button issue. He passed restrictive measures on immigration, on driving if you're an undocumented immigrant, and he was not well received by many in the state. But in the years since then, he has governed, as Jim says, separate from the National Republican Party's agenda, and in many ways has had a rather progressive agenda, yes?
Well, you know, Nathan Deal used to be a Democrat. Jim
right.
and I remember those days.
Yeah.
Yeah, before he went to Congress.
I think
Congress
he switched in 94, 95.
94 yep. when Gingrich became Speaker of the House. Midway through Clinton's first term. He comes from small town Georgia, a lawyer, always on the front pew when church opens up. His wife's an elementary school teacher. I don't think he's, I don't see him as someone who's out of touch with Georgia by any means. And he has carved out a reputation around criminal justice reform that is looked at nationally. And is well received, I think, across the state. There's been a recognition that we're spending too much money on locking people up. We don't have pathways back for people to be a part, the returning citizens from a jail term or a prison term. And he has led in that regard. His son runs a drug court up in Hall County. There's sensitivity to addiction. And then we worked together in a bipartisan way to update and modernize the juvenile justice code. So he has vetoed one of the crazy guns on campus.
And religious liberty.
And he has been very clear-headed on that this religious liberty, and I think you put it well, economic security issues trump the cultural issues.
Julianne, are Let me start with the first part of what Galloway said. Can Georgia members, incumbents in Congress, can they run on the Trump record happily? Or given the what the AJC poll says about Trump's approval rating here, are they going to have to be careful about how much they want to take on Donald Trump as their totem in the election?
Well, I think whether you're talking about Republicans or Democrats, I think when it comes to an issue like Donald Trump or being anti-Trump, those are things you talk about in the primary. Those are not general election issues. And if you're talking about a general election issue, I think that the senator is very correct. You stick to issues that deal with the citizens of Georgia. And I think she's correct that that is why that Nathan Deal has done so well, because he does connect with Georgians. And he's chosen issues like criminal justice reform that pull well, not only across the state, but across party lines. And I think that that is a model for the way that a lot of candidates are going to be running this year.
He's not a bomb thrower. He never has been, no matter what party banner he flew under. He's not.
Right.
He's he looks for solutions and bring people together. And he's, frankly, has some trouble with some real vociferous elements in the GOP and the Senate.
But what I would say, on a longer term, what I would say is that what the poll kind of hints at is that the louder and more the Trump founders, as we approach the May primary, that may give an edge to your comfortable traditional establishment Republican.
Yeah, right.
Casey Cagle,
right,
or Brian Kemp.
Right. All right. We got to get a break in.
Well, there's a lot to talk about.
we're gonna hold it off, because you know what's nice about this? It's January, and we don't have elections coming up until at least May and then November.
That's
so
right.
We'll have weeks and weeks to talk about these things. When we come back, I want to take on one state issue immediately, and that's what happened to the adoption bill in your body, the state Senate, Nan Orrick. But let's get a break in right now. This is Political Rewind. We'll be back in a moment.
Hey, this is David Green, host of Morning Edition. I'm here to talk with you about that poking feeling, the one that keeps reminding you to support public radio. You can support the programs you love by donating your used vehicle. That old car or truck could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station. All you have to do is call, and you might even receive a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR, and thanks.
We're back on Political Rewind. Jim Galloway with me, Senator Nan Orrick, and Julianne Thompson. Very quickly, Julianne, you're saying the issue of Trump comes into play for Republicans in their May primary. You don't run away from Trump in a Republican primary,
you
is what you're saying.
You absolutely do not. You embrace the leadership of the president on the positive issues that he's brought forward and his accomplishments. You don't run away from Trump
All right.
in the primary.
I don't mean to rush it, but I do want to move on to a few more important issues. Nan Orrick, you're a member of the state Senate. The other day, the Senate passed the adoption bill that people have been talking about for a long time, geared to make it easier for families to adopt children here. It's one of the toughest states, one of the longest waiting periods, I understand, for dealing with adoption. There was, for a while, a religious liberty component. That was stripped from the bill. But in the Senate, another provision that is troubling to some was added to the bill, and I think I'm right, and you'll correct me if I'm not, without going into it in great detail, it essentially, the added language, which last year Nathan Deal objected to, essentially gives a birth mother a longer period of time than current law allows, or at least the first provision of the bill allowed, to change her mind and to take her baby back. Have I got that right?
Well, no.
No, I got it wrong.
That's one of the provisions, but it's a fairly minor one.
Oh, okay. What's the bigger one?
I mean, what the governor has called for, rightly so, is a clean, unencumbered abortion modernization. What he's calling for is a clean, unencumbered adoption modernization bill, which was worked on mightily in the House last year. When it came to the Senate, the Senate leadership allowed a debate to break out and allowed an amendment to be put on religious liberty that basically made the bill untenable. everybody in the House leadership, the governor has called for a clean bill. Our lieutenant governor said he would produce that. But what they did was take a vetoed bill.
Right. HB 359.
That's right. HB 359. Take a vetoed bill and put it essentially onto the original adoption bill.
Why?
And okay, well, all right. First of all, this has been
I voted against it.
It's been a cause in the Senate among Senate Republicans for about 4 years. The difference is that this version was actually composed by the House. But what it would do is there's been this push in the Senate for for the privatization of Georgia's foster care movement. This is a small step toward that. It would allow a parent, whether father or mother, whoever has custody of the child, to, through a power of attorney, grant custody of the child for up to a year.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking.
And basically it's a way for the parents to hand off their kids mm-hmm. without involving mm-hmm. the state or the foster care.
So here's the question I want to ask, and Julianne, please jump in too. But here's the question. I'm not quite sure I understand what the politics of this is.
It's a litmus test for the right wing. The Alliance for Life. But it's like no state involvement in parental decisions. You can't tell us what to do. Our kids are our kids, and you can't tell us what to do. And it flies in the face of the realities out here, down on the ground, of broken families, addiction, all sorts of issues that are of dysfunctional family, et cetera. It creates a pathway to shuttle kids around without state oversight. And let me just say, when a child that is in state care falls, into bad hands and is abused, or worst case scenario, loses their life. Everybody's in an uproar about what the state should do and how the state should be involved and why weren't you doing more and why weren't you? And in fact, this takes the state this takes the ability to do oversight on what happens to children.
Julianne, is this one of the bills you've been following in the legislature?
I have
what
been
can
following
tell
this
tell
bill,
us?
And I think that there's no question that you can look at what DFACS has done in the state of Georgia and come to the conclusion that they've done a fantastic job oversighting. I have mixed emotions about this. The bill is good. I do believe in a lot of the changes that were made to the bill. There's a lot of subtle nuances that we're not talking about. We're not talking about the fact that they want to lower the adoption age to 21. And I mean, I understand that in the circumstance of a relative that would need to, say, adopt a brother or a sister, I understand that. But also, it would also allow a 21-year-old man with the original language, a 21-year-old man, because this bill also allows a person to pay an attorney to or give money to an attorney to then pay for the adoption of a child and pay the mother, it would, in an unintended consequence, allow a 21-year-old man, for example, to purchase and get into a bidding war for a child as a single 21-year-old man. And I just think that there's a lot of unintended consequences, especially in a state that has so much sex trafficking problems.
Gotcha.
Okay. But just to back away just a little bit here. Mm-hmm. Okay, in Georgia, right now, under the current situation, there are two kinds of adoptions. There are adoptions through agencies, mm-hmm. and then there are adoptions through private attorneys. Adoptions through agencies are expensive. They can cost maybe $30,000 to $40,000. A private attorney adoption, maybe it's $10,000, maybe even less, okay? So there's a cost issue involved, and that's why Georgia's adoption rate is so low. This bill... under current state law, adoptions conducted through agencies are allowed to give birth mothers living expenses. Say a mother has been ordered on bed rest, can't work. Okay,
right.
An agency is allowed to give living expenses. If in the case of an adoption through a private attorney, That is strictly forbidden.
All right. So let me bring this back out to a really basic. Let me take it back down to politics.
Politics,
this something that the people like Casey Cagle, Lieutenant Governor, President of the Senate, Josh McCoon running for Secretary of State, Michael Williams running for Governor, is this the sort of, is this bill in some ways part of their commitment to try to win votes from the conservative base? Is that what we're saying
here? I think they have really misestimated what's out there. I've gotten letters from all across, from my constituents and across the state, of parents who have adopted and who are want a clean bill as it came from the House and get it signed and get it modernized. But here's what I think. Casey Cagle, Lieutenant Governor, presided over a debacle last year when he allowed the religious freedom language to go on. Now, this bill that's been vetoed has been appended on. And what's going to happen ultimately? I expect a clean bill will come out, but the lieutenant governor could very well bear the onus of having messed with it and not leave that.
Go ahead, Galloway, and then you, Julie, because I want to get Julie in.
You asked, what are the political dynamics behind this?
Uh-huh.
Casey Cagle is behind the addition of adding HB 359
to the
adoption bill. I mean, he orchestrated that. The other portion that which we were talking about the House bill decision to allow private attorneys to give living expenses to birth mothers, mm-hmm. which Julianne objects to, that was the work of David Schaefer,
who's running for lieutenant governor. Julianne, Nan can say she's getting a lot of letters from people who are upset about this, but you're one of the people who's going to probably vote in that Republican primary, and basically your concerns, which you think to some extent this new Senate bill answers, people like Casey Cagle, Michael Williams, whoever, they're playing in the hopes of winning the vote of you and your friends. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think that that's a very fair assessment. I think that both branches can come to, or not both branches, but both sides can come to an agreement on this bill, the House and the Senate, and they can come out with adoption reform here in Georgia. But going back to the temporary placement that Jim was talking about just a second ago, the temporary placement where you sign the power of attorney to put temporary kids in temporary custody, that would deal with the issues that certain military families are facing right now. What is the problem with that? And Senator Orrock, didn't you vote in favor of that last year?
I may have cast a committee vote as a supporting the chair lady who was promoting the bill at some point over these last 4 years. I have not voted for that deal vetoed.
This is going to play out, and I'd like to stop this portion of our conversation simply because I think there's an awful lot to digest here.
Yeah.
I'm finding myself wanting to read more because you've all presented to me information that I'm still a little uncertain about. So if you don't mind, I want to move on to another issue, but I think this is going to be a fascinating story to watch as the legislature continues. And I appreciate all of you giving us so much detail about it. Real quickly, Jim, we're not going to have as much time as I'd like because we've got a big story to get to in our third block. The Trump administration yesterday, they announced, HHS, Health and Human Services, mm-hmm. announced that they were creating something called the Conscience and Religious Freedom Division, which is going to monitor healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, clinic technicians, whatever, to assure that they are not forced or that they do not have to provide services to people whose life styles conflict with theirs. So
with their religious beliefs.
With their religious beliefs. So if somebody comes in wanting a certain kind, you know, could a gay couple come in and be denied services like STD testing, treatment, that sort of thing. And this came out of nowhere and caught an awful lot of people.
No, I don't think it came out of
nowhere. Well, no. In theory, it didn't come out of nowhere, but the creation of this division surprised everyone.
The creation of the division surprised everyone, but it is a continuation and an extension of the religious liberty fight that we've had down here in Georgia.
It's cultural wars.
This one is applied to the federal government. And you've always had some concern out there among doctors and nurses when it comes to things like abortion. Occasionally, you've had pharmacists who refuse to give out birth controls pills to unmarried women. This would kind of address that, take up the cause of those who feel that they've been punished for objecting in these cases. There is the matter also, because we have same-sex marriage on the table now as a legal, legitimate institution here. Yes, there is, concerns, can a psychiatrist or a marriage counselor refuse services to it, to a gay couple?
This thing seems so ripe for a lawsuit. Of all the things that are being done, here's another one to add to the list of challenges in the courts, don't you think, Julianne?
Well, I don't understand why a nurse in an emergency setting should be forced to participate in an abortion if she finds that morally objectionable. I mean, I think that is a lot more what this agency is trying to deal with rather than a pharmacist who will not give birth control pills to a single woman.
So I don't think, Nan, that people are starting, they're kind of absorbing the creation of this division even today, trying to figure out where they stand. We've heard from Planned Parenthood, which of course is upset. We've heard from conservative groups who think this is a protection that's long been needed. But Nan Oreck, I think most medical professional organizations approach these issues by saying that a health worker's, a doctor, for instance, first responsibility is to take care of the patient, not to consider her or his stake in all of this. And I think there's going to probably, because of that, going to be real pushback from some of the major medical organizations around
the
country.
Well, absolutely. I mean, if we get to a place where we're allowing healthcare providers and large institutions to discriminate in the how and who they treat, it's going to harm individual patients. It's going to obstruct our public health response to the HIV/AIDS crisis. And further, medical providers have an ethical and professional obligation to provide all patients with the best care and with humane treatment.
Right. But okay. Here, I think what we have to do is, number one, is sit back and see how this division, this part of the civil rights division, operates and what cases it chooses. But right now, you already have an informal system in which a doctor or nurse's religious objections are observed. For instance, at St. Joseph's Hospital, a Catholic hospital, they do not do abortions. And that's been the case, I think, for decades.
And I know an OBGYN that will not prescribe birth control pills for her patients, but she has four other partners and she allows them. Well, I mean, that is her that is her conviction, and that's something that she should be allowed. That is not refusing care of someone or discriminating against someone. I think there is a solid difference between an issue like that and actually refusing the care of someone.
Right, let me give Nan the last word on this before we get to a break.
When I came into the legislature, AIDS had been identified and the battle was on. And I saw all sorts of dangerously thoughtless policies being proposed, like we got to tattoo everybody that is HIV positive. This continues on to this day of wanting to politicize healthcare. If you don't want to offer to any and all health professional health services, don't go into that field.
Well, but wait a minute. And then how do you respond to Jim pointing out that St. Joseph's Hospital, one of the most respected...
The Catholic lobby is very powerful. I will say that. But that's what this is about.
Wait. Does St. Joseph's, are you saying that they are not acting according to the ethics and morality of the healthcare profession by not providing abortion services, or is it
by denying
fine
abortion
with
services?
By
I'm not fine with that. I'm not fine
okay
with that.
All right,
no, not at all.
So we're going to watch how this plays out. It really did. Jim's right. This has been in the wind. This is certainly a lot of what, in terms of religious liberty, things that the Trump administration has proposed. But the sudden announcement of the creation of this very formally named division caught everybody completely off guard.
So, and I think it's an issue that needs to be dealt with. I just don't know if we need to create another bureaucracy to do it.
There
that's
you go.
The
there's the perfect conservative Republican response.
That's a good point. I mean, that's a you know, fair amount of people can agree on that.
All right, we got to get our last break of the show out of the way. Want to clear the decks, because when we come back, I have one word for the panel.
Dun, 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 dun.
Amazon.
Dun, dun, dun.
This flu season is really one for the record books, with outbreaks occurring all across the U.S. I'm Ira Flatto. This week on Science Friday, why scientists are under pressure to develop a universal vaccine. And you may be using a sleep tracking app, yeah, but is there solid evidence these sleep gadgets and apps really work? The answer's on Science Friday from PRI.
This afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Before we get to Amazon, real quick, Tom Faust has been monitoring the White House meeting between Chuck Schumer and the president. That meeting just ended. Tom says that that Chuck Schumer came out of the meeting saying they made some progress, but they still have problems that they have not resolved, and they're hoping they can continue to talk. So, the deadline approaches at midnight tonight. If they can't get anywhere, there's a government shutdown, and we'll see how that plays out. All right, let's move on. Jim Galloway, your newspaper this morning, I open it up, and to no one's great surprise, the front page screaming that Amazon has narrowed their choice of second headquarters city to 20 cities, and darn it, Atlanta's in the mix.
At the top of the list, alphabetically.
Well, at top of the list, alphabetically. Yeah.
All right, okay. It was advertised as a short list, but it's actually a fairly long list of 20.
Yeah.
I guess it's a short list when you consider the hundreds of thousands of applications that they got.
Yeah, they had 240-some, I think, cities who were interested in the deal. Nanorak, the state has, or the governor has said, we're pulling out all the stops. He suggested that they could do a deal that's worth as much as $1 billion to attract Amazon. He doesn't want to do it in the regular session, which is probably smart. He wants to have a special session so that you're all not completely distracted by this. And
well, can I?
Sure.
There's the reason for the special session is
after the primaries.
Yes. It might be before.
Oh,
but in a special session, the governor gets to determine what is discussed.
That's right.
The parameters of the
and so there would be no blackmailing. You get your Amazon incentives if you vote this way on this bill.
Mm-hmm. So, all right. So let's talk about this, Nan. First of all, what's the appetite among your colleagues in the state legislature, and is it divided along partisan lines about this kind of tax giveaway, $1 billion in incentives?
You know, this is such a huge deal to close the deal, 50,000 jobs that are being touted, and we're talking about a household name, and it's just very interesting about public perception. Amazon is a household name, and it's a behemoth, and on all accounts, its future looks very bright. I'm not hearing a lot of grave questioning of whether we're going to offer a sweet deal to Amazon. What I'm concerned about is that we've talked all through this show about these kind of right wing cultural war bills and postures that are coming up federally and here. And I took to the well the other day to caution our congressional delegation, particularly our junior senator, David Perdue, be careful what you say. Be careful what you embrace. We don't want a adios Amazon scenario going on here when they have all these choices and they look and they see that the bill was reintroduced this week, English as the only language.
Yeah, Josh McCoon. Yeah,
that's right. Signed by, senators all right. we all know and love. And they're not taking into account the head of this behemoth, the head of Amazon, is the son of a Cuban immigrant who arrived here at age 16, speaking no English, successfully raised a family, and his son, we say where Jeff Bezos is today, and he and his wife are funding Dreamer scholarships, and they're going to be very interested, and I hope, but I mean, it's scary to think that they'd be deterred coming to Georgia by these right-wing cultural war scenarios.
So,
David Perdue heads the list.
All right, so, okay, we understand that argument, but let me go back to the money, Julianne. What do you think, if you're a legislator, a Republican legislator in a really conservative district, and your constituents are upset about spending, state spending, they're tired of seeing how much money the state spends, are you going to have to worry about whether you can win re-election if you vote for sweet, really sweet tax breaks for Amazon?
Well, I think that across party lines, people want Amazon to come here. So I think that they're going to come to an agreement. But I think when you're talking about people that are running for governor in the primary, I think you also have to realize that you have to address the grassroots as well. If you're going to give all of these tax incentives to Amazon, you also have to address something like income tax reform. I think that there are many. Well, you laugh if you want to.
No, I mean that's just quite a thought.
Well,
there.
I will tell you. Julianne's got a point. There is, and you saw it with the Georgia's implementation of these tax credits for the movie industry, where you've got some Republicans saying, look, you've got all these people moving into our state, and they're changing us, and we don't want to be changed.
Yeah.
And that's. But the other thing I would. But on the other hand, of course, one of the great journalists of the AJC is sports writer Jeff Schultz, who follows the bookie line out of Vegas. All right. Okay. Nashville is at the top of the list. Of 20 cities at 8-1, Washington D.C. is a 10-1 shot. Atlanta comes in third with a 12-1 chance of getting this.
Interesting.
Let's also say that 12 of the 20 are RFRA states. So that's not something that seems to be precluding them.
Yeah, that's interesting. Indiana, for instance, Indianapolis made the Amazon cut. They're in the 20, and after the mess we saw them go through when Mike Pence was governor over religious liberty, Nan, contrary to your concerns, Amazon says let's look at Indianapolis.
Well, who's to say how different cities got on that list? I don't know. And at Atlanta and Georgia bring a lot of the elements that are on the short list for what Amazon is looking for
Indianapolis may be a bad example, because I think when he was still governor, Governor Pence backed away from.
Well,
Raleigh,
North Carolina is on the list,
and
North Carolina, I mean, certainly has gone through its problems. But all right, let me talk about another issue that I think really resonates, and it's one, Nan, that you all in the legislature, you as an elected official have to be concerned about. Mm-hmm. There is significant concern that we already have a problem with affordable housing. Contractors, developers really are reluctant to build affordable housing right now. They're tending toward going toward more expensive homes for professional people, apartment buildings, condos, whatever. And there are some concerns that Amazon is going to attract an employee base that will only continue that disparity and, in fact, will continue this notion of Atlanta being having the largest income disparity in the country. Your response to that?
Well, I think the 50,000 jobs narrative washes away many concerns. I don't run into the attitude that you're talking about, Bill, of people fearing change and cultural expansion and more cosmopolitan elements coming to the state. I don't hear that because I'm in a cosmopolitan area. But I do think there are genuine questions that to be posed, and we've been raising them over time, around tax expenditures, that is, the tax breaks, and how much of a break and how much of a cut do you give, and when does it become a zero-sum game? And our finance committee has actually been looking at the concept that let's make these tax giveaway decisions over a two-year period where they're really weighed and you drill down and you don't just take the supplicant that's coming asking for the tax break at their word, but you put in a lot more parameters and a lot more accountability and a look back, that sort of thing.
Let me read
that
something.
I think people can agree with that no matter what party they're in.
Let me read something to you from the AJC's front page article on this. The city faces a housing crisis as inexpensive homes dwindle and developers focused almost exclusively on building luxury apartments. Top housing experts are warning city officials Atlanta cannot absorb a projected influx of 50,000 Amazon workers without major spending and policy changes to bring housing for middle and low income residents.
And that's very
residents.
Much on the front burner. Oh, yeah. Our Atlanta delegation, I just came from there to this program, has set up a special task force on affordable housing. It is absolutely a front burner issue. And we're going to be having a community meeting on Monday night over at Carver High School to continue to push forward.
Right. And quite frankly, if there are several sites within the city limits of Atlanta that are being considered. I would say right now the top one that state and city officials are trying to push is the Gulch,
mm-hmm.
Which is where the old
downtown
AJ,
back where yeah
where the old AJC building was, and it kind of links up with Underground Atlanta. And
right.
if that complex goes in there, then yeah, I think you've got a serious housing problem. I think you've got a serious racial problem because as the people who are getting pushed out are African American.
Julianne, you get the last word on it.
I'd like to go back to what I said about fairness with regard to taxation before that you kind of laughed at a little
the
bit.
The income tax issue.
That's right. Wasn't one of the issues with tax reform on a federal level from Democrats is because they felt like corporations were getting all these tax breaks, yet individuals were not. Isn't it a little bit hypocritical on the part of the Democratic Party to believe that at the federal issue, but to be perfectly fine with Amazon getting all these massive tax breaks and movie industry getting all these massive tax breaks in Georgia, but yet you scoff and you laugh when I mention income tax reform
for the
grassroots? You've
got about 45 seconds before we're over off the air to respond to that.
Thank you, Bill. And 45 seconds to deal about federal and state tax policy. We have one of the lowest income tax rates anywhere around. We need revenue in this state, and we have, in fact, made many regressive tax changes, which place the burden of taxation on the poor and the underemployed. And so to go messing right, nobody pays more than 10% on state income tax now.
But we're giving massive tax incentives to Amazon.
All right, I got
to
cut you off. And here's the most important point as you both debate this. No matter what we say in this studio,
mm-hmm.
There's going to be a big effort to get Amazon to come to Atlanta.
That's right. That's right.
All right. We are really out of time for today's show. Nan Orrick, so good to have you. And again, congratulations
on being inducted
in the International Civil Rights Walk of Fame. Julianne Thompson, a real pleasure to have you
with us.
And Jim Galloway, my good friend. You know, I'm always glad when you're here. We're going to be back Monday at 2 o'clock. Ricky Bevington, who hosts the All Things Considered broadcast in Atlanta,
uh-huh.
is going to be taking my place. I'm getting on a plane early tomorrow morning and flying out to Park City, Utah, where they're expecting a big snowfall tomorrow morning. And I got to go buy some really good waterproof boots before I go.
and some ski wax.
We're going to the Sundance Film Festival. So I'll see you back here on Wednesday. But again, Ricky will be here with another Political Rewind on Monday.
Thanks.
Take care. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.